Hello, and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm your host for today, David Dayan. I'm a journalist who writes for In These Times, The Intercept, The New Republic, and many more. I'm filling in today for Ian Masters, who is on vacation. We have a great show for you today. First up, we're going to talk about one of the biggest issues facing consumer pocketbooks, the high cost of prescription drugs. A new bill from Senator Bernie Sanders would lower the cost of medications to their price in other industrialized countries like Canada, the UK, France, Germany, and Japan. And we're going to talk about it with Senator Sanders' co-author, Congressman Ro Khanna, who represents the 17th District of California. Then, the plan to block out the sun. Climate change has become such a threat to human life and our economic future that some scientists are considering what sound like science fiction ideas to mitigate the worst effects, like sucking carbon out of the atmosphere or literally dimming the sun. We will talk about this geoengineering with journalist Kate Aronoff, who has a cover story at In These Times magazine on the subject. Finally, we're going to look at a new book called The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. It's a concise history of the political battle against monopolies and how our inattention to the subject has led to extreme amounts of concentrated corporate power. Author Tim Wu, who coined the term net neutrality, will discuss the book and how we can restore the anti-monopoly movement. So keep it here for the next hour of Background Briefing with your host, David Dayan. Well, healthcare was a big topic of the midterms, and in particular, the high cost of prescription drugs. U.S. patients pay far more for medications than any other industrialized country, and leaders in both parties, including even President Trump, have suggested some changes to the system. We're going to talk to one of those leaders right now. Congressman Ro Khanna represents California's 17th Congressional District, located in Silicon Valley. He's serving his first term right now. His second term will be in January. He sits on the House Budget and Armed Services Committees. He's a vice chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And he and Senator Bernie Sanders announced last week that they will introduce the Prescription Drug Price Relief Act at the start of the new Congress. Ro Khanna, thank you for coming on Background Briefing.
Absolutely. I appreciate your discussing the issue and having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you. So this bill is about a compulsory licensing of prescription drugs. And maybe we should explain sort of what the current process looks like, the current patent system for drugs, and how that leads to high prices.
Now, the bill is very simple. It says that Americans shouldn't pay more for drugs than our counterparts pay in Britain and France and Germany and Canada and Japan. What it says is if Americans are paying more for their drugs than the average price in these other countries, then the U.S. government will take away the monopoly power that we are giving the pharmaceuticals in the form of a patent and open it up to generic competition. And this is sort of common sense. If you go into CVS and you're shopping for drugs and you want to get the actual Afrin or a brand name Sudafed, you're going to pay a lot more. When you go get the generic, it's a lot less. And we're saying that if the Americans are paying more for drugs than people are in other countries, they should have the generic option. This would dramatically lower prices for drugs that people use every day, like Advair for asthma. It would save almost 50% if you did this. Humira for arthritis. You would save over 50% if you did this. So that's the essence of the bill.
Great. So price setting, I mean, relative to the price of drugs in other countries, I guess there's sort of a list, a master list that you'll create of a series of industrialized countries and then say that if the price is excessive beyond that, then we're going to let generic competition come in. That's actually kind of similar to what President Trump has proposed on a very tiny class of drugs under Medicare Part B. He said that we want the prices to be like the prices are in other countries. I mean, do you think there's sort of an opening for even bipartisan cooperation on this kind of idea?
There is. I mean, this takes his idea and fleshes it out. I mean, he's doing an international price point for about 3% of drugs on Medicare, basically, right. Drugs that are administered at a hospital or in a doctor's office qualify, and he would look at the international price point and ask Medicare to reimburse at that price point. There's not the same enforcement mechanism. He's not saying otherwise give people a generic alternative, but he is looking at an international price point. showing that this is actually a market solution. And what we're saying is don't just limit it to 3% of the drugs. Make this an international price point for every drug that Americans may use. And let's have teeth in it by opening it up to generic competition, which is to be clear, it's the government taking away monopoly power that it's giving pharmaceuticals.
Right.
Now, there are reasons for giving a monopoly in the form of a patent, and that reason may be that it encourages research and development and innovation. But those patents may be necessary for the first few years. It gives companies a first-mover advantage. By the time the drug is competing for an international price, they've already had that innovation bump. And all this bill is saying is we shouldn't be giving them an artificial monopoly, which is what a patent is.
Right. And under the bill, the generic manufacturer does have to pay sort of a royalty for the right to produce the drug to the original company. How do you ensure that that generic company doesn't end up excessively pricing the drug in their own right?
Well, the administrators would look at that to make sure that the generics are charging paying a reasonable price. And currently, the generic pricing are far, far lower than the patented drugs. And so I think I read somewhere that maybe 10% or 12% of drugs are actually the original patents, but they account for 77% of the healthcare costs.
Right.
So the generics are not the problem in terms of the cost, and I expect that it would just be a reasonable fee, not the excessive profits that are going to shareholders.
Yeah, I think within the bill it says the royalty has to be very reasonable so that they can be priced accordingly. There are a number of bills out there that sort of have these goals of reducing prescription drug prices. I saw one introduced by Senator Merkley that also uses a reference list of international prices. There's one by Congressman Doggett of Texas.
Doggett is a good bill.
Lloyd Doggett, yeah.
Doggett.
It's
yeah.
a compulsory licensing bill that's limited sort of to Medicare. But my question is, so Doggett is on the Energy and Commerce Committee. That would be the committee of jurisdiction taking on
right. Ways
any—
and means. Ways and means.
Oh, he's on Ways and
Ways
Means.
And means.
Okay, right.
Which
but
is
that,
the committee of jurisdiction.
That would have jurisdiction taking on any kind of pharmaceutical legislation, and
right.
you aren't. So have you spoken with him about your bill and what we
I
might
have.
See coming out of Ways and Means?
I have. He was joking. He said we need more progressive allies on the committee. I said, Lloyd, you got to carry the ball right now. But he's terrific. He's a terrific member. His bill called for Medicare negotiation, and then if opening it up to generic competition, it's a good bill. I think this bill it goes even further. He's open to this type of an approach. And I think he's going to be a great ally on the Ways and Means Committee to push for this policy.
Well, that's interesting that you mentioned that he said you need more horses in Ways and Means.
He literally did. And he said, the Ways and Means Committee needs more progressives. Now, Pramila Jayapal and Mark Pocan, the chairs of the Progressive Caucus, got a commitment
to
Nancy Pelosi that we need to have more progressives on these committees. You know, they're called the money committees. And progressive joke, when you're a centrist Democrat, you kind of come to Congress and you dream about getting on Ways and Means or Energy and Commerce. When you're a progressive, you come to Congress and you dream about sort of changing the world, and you're not thinking about these committees. But we've got to get smarter about where policy is being made and get on the quote-unquote money committees and have a seat at the table. So Doggett is a real asset in Congress. He's a true progressive, and he's on these on this committee in a senior role, and we need others to be supportive of him.
Absolutely. That's what I want to ask about, because I've actually written about that at The Intercept, about the challenge in getting existing members who have committee assignments and are gaining seniority through those committees to switch onto these money committees to fulfill this proportional requirement or promise. I mean, you're on the Armed Services Committee and the Budget Committee.
Yeah.
I'm not sure you'll be seeking a change in assignment, but, how are we going to find members willing to go onto these committees through what so much critical legislation goes through?
Well, I appreciate very much the question. And I think the key is waivers. If you look at the New Democrats, and if you look at centrist Democrats, 20 members on the Democratic side have gotten a waiver to serve on their original committee and also to serve on one of these select committees or money committees.
Right, because let's just explain, you're normally, if you're on one of these money committees, you're formally speaking not supposed to be able to serve on a different committee within Congress.
Correct.
And you're saying that these new Dems have gotten these waivers, but progressives haven't necessarily.
Right, and so I think some of the progressives don't even know that these waivers exist. And so what they think is, okay, I don't want to give up my role on judiciary, or I don't want to give up my role on foreign affairs. I will continue to be there, and I'm not even going to seek one of these exclusive committees. But we've got to be more savvy about it, and we've got to say, no, we want to have Pramila Jayapal on judiciary, but also have her serve on one of the exclusive committees. We want to make sure that people can do both. And I think that this is part of the conversation that the Progressive Caucus had with Nancy, is not just that we need proportional representation, we need proportional waivers.
Yeah, interesting. That's a really interesting point. So I'm talking to Congressman Ro Khanna of California's 17th Congressional District.
And, you know, your writing was very thoughtful, and it's a broader philosophical question for progressives because, you know, progressives, I think, are very good in mobilization. We're very good at vision. We're very good at policy. But in D.C., the brass tactics of understanding procedural maneuvering matter. It's
right.
Al McConnell, who has no vision, no oratorical skills, no mobilization, is still so effective in getting his way. And I think one lesson for progressives is we really have to understand the details, the nitty-gritty of power, of understanding how to get on the right committees, how to get the right waivers. And that's been an education process for us, and I think we're making progress.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the compliment. I wasn't fishing for it. So just to go into another detail just regarding prescription drugs, and I want to ask you a couple other questions about some other things. Under the Buy-Dole Act of 1980, this says that any drug benefiting from federal funding, which is basically any drug, must be made available on reasonable terms, and the government can seize those patents and license them to other countries if not achieved. It's similar to your bill, and it's already the law. I mean, should we get a Democratic president, it seems to me that this would be a way to enact or to implement something like you're talking about without having to pass it through Congress.
That's a great point, and I think we need to make sure that that's part of the platform of our Democratic candidates who are running for president, that they would implement this. And it's another aspect of what we were discussing earlier of the exercise of powers in smart ways. I mean, Trump has unfortunately found every loophole to exert executive power for conservative policy. And this wouldn't be a loophole. It would just be a thoughtful way of exerting executive power that exists. And so I definitely think that while we're not in power in these next 2 years, a lot of research should be done of what a progressive president would be able to do, what levers are available to her or to him the day they get into office.
Right, absolutely. And in this case, it's executive power that was granted by the legislative branch over 30 years ago. So I wanted to get your reaction to a couple things that happened yesterday in Congress. First, there was this resolution from Senator Sanders and some others that was voted upon in the Senate to discharge from committee this resolution, a War Powers Act resolution, to end U.S. support for the war in Yemen. And it passed on a surprising vote of 63-37. This is the same resolution that you have attempted to pass in the House of Representatives. And I just wanted to get your reaction to that vote yesterday and what it means for the prospects of actually ending this humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen.
Well, it's a huge step. And I give great credit to Senator Sanders for his perseverance. You know, we introduced the War Powers Resolution in the House about a year and a half ago. The Republican leadership didn't allow a vote, but we got a compromise resolution passed that for the first time acknowledged the United States' role in the Saudi civil war, admitting that we were refueling Saudi planes and assisting with targeting. Based on that admission, Senator Sanders about a year ago introduced the War Powers Resolution in the Senate, and we got 44 votes. And then we were thinking, how do we continue the momentum? Well, after Khashoggi, I spoke with Senator Sanders, and we both felt that there was momentum to re-explore the issue. And, of course, the civilian deaths in Yemen were mounting. So we tried to introduce it in the House. Unfortunately, Paul Ryan played games. They didn't allow a clean vote, and we were stymied. Senator Sanders was, through tactical brilliance, able to convince Menendez and Corker and a few other senators to flip. And I'm very, very heartened about this. And now we have the momentum and the obligation to get something through in the House.
Yeah, and I understand if you pass a war powers resolution like this in the House, there are greater protections. It can't really be as veto-proof. Is that correct?
It's not veto-proof, right. I mean, if we pass it, the president is obligated to stop all support of the Saudi war.
And that's true in the House, but not necessarily in the Senate?
If it passes both, it's got to pass both chambers.
Well, of course, but where it originates, I think, might be the issue.
Is that the case? You
know, yeah, I believe so. I don't want to tell a congressman what the role is.
You should
definitely check my work.
All the time. You know, it may be. I didn't know that the point of origination matters. But my understanding is if it passes both chambers, the president can veto it. And it's never happened in American history that war powers pass in opposition to the president.
It happened once before in Somalia that
they passed the war powers resolution, but then Clinton wanted that, and so he welcomed it. But in this case, it would probably go to the Supreme Court, because I think Trump would not be inclined to comply, and he would challenge it, and it'll end up in the court.
Right.
But it would be such a statement that the United States Congress didn't want our involvement, that the Trump administration itself, I think, would have extraordinary leverage with the Saudis and would put pressure to end the war, which is the main objective.
Yeah, excellent. Great signal of what happened. Finally, I just want to ask the last question. You were very vocal yesterday about the loss of Barbara Lee in this leadership race between her and Hakeem Jeffries for caucus chair. I just want to get your reaction to that and why you think Congressman Lee, who's obviously a progressive icon, was unable to win that race yesterday.
Well, I was talking to Barbara, and she gave me a sobering fact. In 1977, Shirley Chisholm ran for caucus chair and got 100 votes, and Barbara Lee ended up in 2018 with 113 votes. Hmm. And she said, it's tough being a black woman in American politics, and the progress has been that slow. I think there are institutional barriers. I mean, the women were for her, the new members were for her, a lot of the very outspoken progressives were for her, but there are still, it's still an institution that is tough to navigate, and where the membership is probably much more conservative than where the base of our party is. Look, I have nothing against Hakeem Jeffries. He's a good person. I just think Barbara Lee is deserving of a leadership role, given everything she has done for our party and country.
Well, Congressman Ro Khanna, I want to thank you for joining us on Background Briefing today.
Thank you. Thank you for your work.
Congressman Ro Khanna represents California's 17th congressional district. He and Senator Bernie Sanders have this bill that's going to be introduced in the new Congress. It's called the Prescription Drug Price Relief Act. Time for a quick break, but we'll be back on Background Briefing with Kate Aronoff, who has written an article about geoengineering, the plan to literally block out the sun to prevent the worst effects of climate change.
Shining, who cares what it does since you broke my heart? Who loves the sun? Not everyone.
Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm David Dayan, filling in for Ian Masters. Last week, on the day after Thanksgiving, I guess for maximum exposure, the U.S. government issued the fourth National Climate Assessment, and this was another in sort of a sobering series of reports suggesting that we are not doing nearly enough to mitigate the worst effects of climate change. The warming planet is shaping up as an ecological, economic, and humanitarian disaster, and it's led some scientists to consider solutions that maybe at first glance might seem absurd, using giant vacuums to suck carbon out of the atmosphere or literally dimming the sun. This is not science fiction. This is real life. But are these early efforts into geoengineering the planet likely to work? Do they have side effects that are unpalatable? And do they let carbon polluters off the hook for the damage they've caused and may continue to cause? Well, my guest has written about this. Her name is Kate Aronoff. She's a Brooklyn-based journalist covering climate and U.S. politics. She contributes to The Intercept and In These Times. I do as well, actually, to both of those. And she has the cover story in These Times magazine this month. It's called Inside Geoengineers' Risky Plan to Block Out the Sun. Kate Aronoff, thank you for being on Background Briefing.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So maybe first we should talk about this National Climate Assessment, which was very helpfully released the day after Thanksgiving. Tell us about the details of this report.
Yeah, so I very frankly have not read all 1,600 pages of this report.
We'll let you off the hook for that. That's
I assume you don't want bullet by bullet point detail. But what's interesting about this report is that, you know, it tells us a lot of things that folks who have been paying attention to climate change and sort of the latest science are pretty familiar with. So not unlike the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report released last month, it's kind of a clearinghouse for research that's been going on for some time. So scientists have been working on this since 2015. It's the second volume of a report that's produced every 4 years. And so this is sort of a thing that happens fairly regularly. What it says is, you know, in no uncertain terms, the climate is changing faster than it has at any point in history. And that is definitely due to human activity. And then it sort of goes into what the effects of that are likely to look like, sort of collating, you know, the number of people who are likely to die due to things like increased heat waves, more deaths from, you know, insect-related diseases, air pollution, wildfires, hurricanes, sort of the full range of climate impacts, particularly in the U.S. And then another thing it does sort of interestingly is kind of add up what the projected costs of all of those impacts are likely to be. And so that's both from deaths, from sea level rise, from the kind of massive infrastructural damage and relocations that will happen, as well as things like trade disruptions. And so looking at, you know, what are the American companies who will be affected by, say, you know, rising tides in places like Thailand, where they might get sort of inputs for the products that they produce, what effect will that have on the economy overall?
Right.
And so, you know, the cost, which, you know, is again not new information, is just staggering. I mean, $141 billion from heat-related deaths, $118 billion from sea level rise, $32 billion from infrastructure damage. And the sort of, you know, headline figure is that by 2100, the losses will be about double those caused by the Great Recession. Hmm. And so those figures, you know, I think you could kind of look under the hood a little bit and sort of see, you know, what does it actually mean for GDP to go down by 10% by 2100? Is that a figure that really makes sense? But the real takeaway is just this will be massively, massively expensive and very, very deadly.
Yeah. Wow. It's really staggering. And I think because even though it was written prior to the Trump administration, but this was a government report that came out of the Trump administration, it seemed to have sort of a larger political impact. And members across the political spectrum seemed to feel the need that they had to react to this. And I want to talk about the conservative reaction, because you had Trump himself sort of denying his own – the report that his own government put out. But you also had people like Marco Rubio and Mike Lee trying to shift the conversation. And they were really talking about sort of, well, we have to innovate our way out of this. Could you just talk about what those types of conservatives, how they reacted?
Yeah, it's funny to see the sort of never Trump wing pivot around climate change, because they're not, of course, going to come out and say, you know, we actually believe this report, but they take, you know, this sort of strange line that will like develop technology. And I think that's becoming more and more common. I think a couple years ago, you may well have seen Marco Rubio sounding more like Trump has. But, you know, his district is
underwater.
Florida is going to be hit very badly. And so he, you know, has this sort of understanding that he can't just flagrantly deny this stuff. Ben Sasse sort of who, you know, went on, I forget what Sunday morning show, to say that, you know, we need to innovate our way out of this, like you said. But it's unclear what actually that means. I mean, I think what it means is that we should be developing, you know, new technologies to deal with this. So that could mean, you know, the sort of standard all of the above energy approach, so we can innovate, you know, more solar power and wind power, but not importantly taking fossil fuels out of the picture.
Right.
And, you know, there's this focus on technology as kind of a savior, even among folks who won't kind of own up to the fact that climate change is happening, that it's caused by human activity and industrial activity in particular. So I think, yeah, when Ben Sasse and company kind of say innovation is the way forward, you know, I don't know if they have a clear idea of what that means. But
I mean, I think the clearest idea that they have is that we can throw a lot of money at some, you know, some company that might get us out of this mess or something. But this sort of techno-optimism that you're talking about really plays into your cover story at In These Times. Maybe just sort of define our terms here. What is geoengineering?
Yeah, so geoengineering doesn't really exist in the abstract. So it refers to kind of a suite of fairly specific technologies. So in a kind of literal sense, geoengineering is defined as, you know, any intentional large-scale change to the atmosphere and the weather. And so, you know, we've technically been doing geoengineering or a form of it for some time, maybe not intentionally, but
right.
You know, by pumping massive amounts of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases into the air. So, you know, one could consider that a form of geoengineering. But when it's talked about in the kind of scientific literature and in climate policy discussions, it usually refers to one of two things. So one is something known as solar radiation management, and that is a proposal to, by any number of means, be it an airplane with a kind of dispersal mechanism attached, to spew out aerosol particulates into the atmosphere that will absorb and deflect sunlight. And so bring down the Earth's temperature through that, effectively, you know, dimming the sun. The other is something known as carbon dioxide removal. And so that's a very, very different process, which would capture carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and store it somewhere.
Right.
So
those are the two things we're talking about. And you note in the article, like, it seems like we've crossed over into science fiction when we're talking about these concepts. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like it's like an analog to how CSI has convinced everyone that DNA testing is completely infallible, like that there has to be some technological answer to every murder or every attempted murder or whatever. We have this sort of overriding belief that things should work out the way they do in fiction. And I think that sort of defines this kind of belief in geoengineering as sort of a savior technology.
Yeah, and things, I mean, the popular representations of geoengineering famously do not work out. I mean, the two biggest ones are, which I mentioned in the piece, are Snowpiercer, in which, you know, the opening premise to why this train is kind of circling a frozen planet indefinitely is a geoengineering experiment gone wrong. And then Geostorm, which is a sort of horrible movie that came out, I think, last year, you know, the sort of Ayn Rand tale of a character who mounts a series of satellites that you know, bring the Earth's climate into, you know, a stable place,
right.
And then it goes haywire for any number of reasons. But yeah, I mean, the stories about these popularly are very, very scary. So it's funny also in that context to see people refer to them as kind of saviors or, you know, a quick fix.
Just to remind viewers, I'm talking with Kate Aronoff. She's a journalist who covers climate, and she has this article in These Times called Inside Geoengineers' Risky Plan to Block Out the Sun. So is this technology proven in any real way yet? I mean, how far are we away from knowing whether or not this would even, you know, make a dent in sort of climate mitigation?
So to speak specifically about solar radiation management, we really can't know. I mean, what we have models that sort of give a good sense for mm-hmm. what this might look like. And the models, you know, present a picture, which is, I think to some people, fairly compelling, which is that if this were deployed, it could, you know, bring down the Earth's temperature to a considerable degree. What that doesn't capture is sort of all of the risks that really can't be modeled. And so one of the, I think, most horrifying potential side effects of solar radiation management is right. that, you know, if at any point you stop the kind of dispersal mechanism that's putting these particulates out and blocking out the sun, the Earth's temperature could rise very, very rapidly, virtually overnight. You know, within a span of a couple of years, the Earth's temperature could shoot up by 3 or 4 degrees, which would be far more damaging to the Earth's systems than even the kind of climate change we're likely to experience if we do nothing, just because it would be so, so rapid right. and not give ecosystems and communities time to adapt. And there's this whole sort of range of impacts that we just don't know, and we can't know because right. there's no way to test this stuff right. unless, you know,
we don't have another planet out there that we can check it
right.
out with.
Yeah. Right. The only test you can do is to take, you know, the entire Earth or maybe a hemisphere and start
yeah.
doing it.
And that sort of brings us to the question of who gets to decide whether or not to deploy this, right? So a large, powerful country can determine that, well, we got to try to dim the sun for our personal survival, but the rest of the world will feel these effects and they may not have had a say in the matter.
Right. And I think the democracy questions really get left out of this. I mean, the flip side of kind of entrusting the solution to climate change with a kind of small group of scientists like this is that, you know, there are a lot of people who are not involved in that decision-making process. And I think unless, you know, you are supportive of, you know, one country, even one corporation, deploying this kind of technology unilaterally, which will have profound impacts on our climate, profound impacts on, you know, everything from agriculture to, you know, the content of the air, then it's not actually easier, right? Like
right.
if we were to earnestly try to develop the sort of democratic decision-making mechanism that would create a process which would, you know, decide when we wanted to pull the trigger on something like this. I'm not,
right.
you know, I'm not convinced that that's actually easier than decarbonizing the economy through
right.
through other means.
I mean, it seems like it was hard enough to get an international agreement, however flimsy it is, on climate and carbon reduction. It mm-hmm. would seem exponentially more difficult to get an international agreement on whether or not we're going to block out the sun.
Right, right.
So the other concern that you bring up in the article, and I think it's very valid, is this idea that relying on geoengineering is this sort of deus ex machina to bring in at the end of once we've polluted the planet so much. It sort of gives an out so that the companies that were spewing these greenhouse gas emissions get to sort of continue to do it, or they don't have to scale back as radically as we thought because we have this thing in the attic that we can bring out. Is that a viable concern in your view?
I think it's a viable concern. I mean, what's so interesting about the geoengineering space, which, you know, is a relatively small group of scientists that accounts for about 1% of all climate research, is that nobody will quite say that. Like, nobody I talk to would say, you know, we can do this and we, you know, it'll give us more. This is a solution.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is very adamant about the fact that we need to decarbonize other parts of the economy, that, you know, this is not a solution. This is something at the very most which can buy us more time. And I think it's hard to tell, you know, how much of that is sort of politicking, and they know that it's really in poor taste, I think, to say
right.
that, you know, this is a solution for Exxon or Shell.
Right.
And you have people like Newt Gingrich who will say that and who have kind of posed it as a
right.
potential
solution. I mean, that's the fear, right? That,
right.
you know, once you put this out there, that people who have an interest in maintaining the status quo will just point to it and say, well, we don't have to worry about reducing carbon emissions. We have this sun-blocking device.
Right, yeah. And I think that's what's sort of hugely dangerous about this. And you know, the word that folks used to refer to this as moral hazard, in that it could, you know, just provide,
exactly.
more cover.
Exactly. But, I mean, all of that being said, are things so drastic, not just as a matter of sort of atmospheric reality, but politically, that we need to start considering geoengineering as part of a solution, as the IPCC does in their report, right?
Yeah, and I mean, this is where the distinction between solar radiation management and carbon dioxide removal, I think, becomes pretty important, in that the IPCC isn't very seriously considering solar radiation management. I mean, they mention it, and some of the folks I talk to are very critical of solar radiation management, were worried about that in particular, that it was, you know, framed even as a potential solution, even if they don't give it much time. But what does play a huge, huge role in the IPCC projections is a form of carbon dioxide removal. And, you know, something that there are tests for. I mean, there are sort of experimental level kind of prototypes.
Yeah, you mentioned one in the story, right, about one that was pulling out the equivalent of one household in America's carbon emissions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and these technologies remain just hugely expensive. Like, it would be, you know, kind of unthinkable to deploy them at even the sort of mild scale that, you know, the most generous projections for how we get to 1.5 degrees say would be needed, which is, you know, very small. But some projections, you know, project needing massive, massive amounts of this stuff, which is at this point, you know, just totally unfathomable.
And,
so, I mean, I think there is a not uncompelling case that, you know, maybe there should be some research into this. I think it's complicated to talk about those two things, SRM and carbon dioxide removal, as the same thing, just because
right.
the sort of impacts are so, so different, and the, you know, potential risks are so, so different. And that SRM has this profound planetary impact. CDM, the risks, I think, are a bit less.
Right. But there is the one thing of, once you capture all this carbon, where do you put it? And that seems to be the nub of the whole thing.
Right. The figure I saw was, I think it would be at least double the current pipeline infrastructure in the U.S. to capture all of the carbon.
Fairly significant. Fairly significant. So tell us, who is mobilizing against geoengineering? Because you quote some of them in your story.
Yeah, so there's a couple groups who have been in this space. I mean, the biggest one is the ETC group, which is kind of a green technology watchdog. And they, you know, have been sort of active about this at the international level, especially. It's folks from, you know, all over the world. They actually just released the People's Demands in the lead up to COP24, which starts next week, sort of saying what they have before, which is that, you know, these technologies should be highly, highly scrutinized and questioned and kind of left off the table of any climate negotiations. And, you know, this includes indigenous tribes from all over the world, indigenous nations, sort of climate justice groups. Kind of, you know, there are some like European Greens involved, kind of a wide spectrum.
So, I mean, you can kind of think about this whole topic in terms of who's for it and who's against it as sort of a proxy. And you're talking about the green groups being skeptical and Newt Gingrich being all for it. So that kind of leads you in a direction a little bit. But we just have a minute or so left, and I want to ask one other thing. You recently wrote in The Intercept, and this might be of interest to our California listeners, about Governor Jerry Brown and his legacy on climate. He's obviously seen, I think, popularly nationally as someone who is very strong on green technologies and climate change, but it's not necessarily as advertised as you say in the story. So could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, Jerry Brown is such a complicated figure, as I'm sure anyone who follows California politics is well aware. He does have a very, very strong climate record. I mean, California has far and away the most ambitious climate policy of any state in the country, and, you know, arguably in the Western Hemisphere. Sort of, you know, has met its carbon emissions reduction goals 4 years early, thanks to all of these, you know, really powerful renewable portfolio standards and all of these things. And so it's hard to sort of, you know, argue with that. It's hard to argue that California is not leading in some sense on climate. What Brown's vision has sort of left out is the need to constrain fossil fuel supply. California has been historically one of the country's biggest producers of oil and gas, and that's gone down a little bit, but there's still, you know, a reluctance on the part of Brown to enforce, you know, some pretty basic restrictions on the fossil fuel industry. And, you know, there are studies sort of saying that it could have a huge impact on the climate, the equivalent of taking something like millions of cars off the road. If Brown were to take sort of basic steps towards a phase out, not, you know, immediately getting rid of all oil and gas production in the state, but kind of gradually winding down that. And so that, you know, has not been something that the administration has been willing to consider. And I think it's interesting to, you know, looking toward the next governor, toward Gavin Newsom, whether or not that will get sort of added in. You know, I think we will see how seriously Gavin Newsom is taking climate change, but it could be sort of a new day and, you know, a chance for there to be some really strong sort of supply side action on climate change, meaning, you know, moving to keep more fossil fuels in the ground.
Yeah. Well, we certainly will see what happens. I want to thank you, Kate Aronoff, for coming on Background Briefing. Kate is a contributor to The Intercept and In These Times. And the article at In These Times is Inside You Engineers' Risky Plan to Block Out the Sun. Kate, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a break right now on Background Briefing, but we'll be back with author Tim Wu, who has a new book out called The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder if she's gone to stay. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone.
Well, he says he's got a big boat with a high roof, and everybody knows his name. Oh, it's a big boat, and it pumps up a poor boy's pride. Says he's got a big boat, it's just a ferry boat, and that makes for a shore ride. Says he's got a big boat with a wide floor.
Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm David Dayan, filling in for Ian Masters. In the first segment today, we were talking about pharmaceuticals. In the second segment, we were talking about climate change and big oil and coal. Those are just two sectors of the economy where a handful of companies seem to be grabbing all the profits. And concentrated corporate power has numerous damaging effects on a society, not just through consumer prices, but the quality of service, innovation, worker wages, inequality of wealth, inequality of region, and even democracy itself. A new book explores the history of monopoly and the fight against big corporate concentration and explains why we're in what can be called a second Gilded Age. And it's my pleasure to have the author on right now, Tim Wu, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times, best known for coining the phrase net neutrality. And he's been working on this competition policy issue for a number of years. His new book is called The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. Tim Wu, welcome to Background Briefing.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So your book sort of traces this history of monopoly power in America, I guess, from the Boston Tea Party to Facebook. And you talk about this new Gilded Age. Why do you believe our economy has these characteristics that go back to sort of the truss of the turn of the 20th century?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think there are two reasons that make our times look a lot like then. The first is something you referred to in the introduction, the idea that more and more industries are dominated by fewer and fewer companies. You know, the Gilded Age is characterized by complete monopolization of many industries, steel, Standard Oil, tobacco, cotton, industry after industry just as a monopoly. And I think we're in a position which isn't exactly that level, but is close. If you look, you were talking about pharmaceuticals earlier, oil again, some of the tech industries, the airline industry, kind of cable, it goes on and on and on, the number of areas in which we've reached kind of almost unprecedented levels of concentration. And I think the second big similarity is the return of inequality, of a very large divide in wealth between the upper 1% or even 0.1% of earners and the rest of the economy. That was a kind of the defining characteristic of the Gilded Age, the original Gilded Age, very wealthy tycoons, but diminishing returns for workers. Things were even more extreme back then, again, so it's not exactly. But I think these are the two big structural things that make our times look like 100 years ago.
Yeah. So the curse of bigness, that's a reference to a collection of writings by Louis Brandeis, who we know is a Supreme Court justice, but also the top economic advisor to Woodrow Wilson in the 1912 presidential election. You really cite this as an important fulcrum point in our history. What was the importance of Brandeis and that 1912 election?
Yeah, that's another great question. I think in the economic history of the United States, that was a critical moment because Brandeis and Wilson were running on a campaign that called for a breakup of all the trusts, a continuation of the policies that had seen, you know, most of the major trusts be challenged and broken into pieces. He was facing other candidates, Eugene Debs, who was a socialist, and Theodore Roosevelt, who had become who had taken on a new policy, and they both called for monopolized economy, controlled by government. So those were different ideas, sort of more nationalistic. They resemble later in time some of the fascist economies in the 30s, and also some of the communist countries. So there's this critical moment where America rededicated itself to the idea of, I would say, smallness. And Brandeis was a big figure in this. His ideas were very influential. He remains influential in a way. I think we've forgotten a lot of what he stood for, but part of my book is suggesting we need to re-understand the ideas of Brandeis and why they were so important.
Right, like almost a new Brandeis movement, which I guess you're sort of part of. It's interesting that you mentioned Roosevelt, because Roosevelt started this third party in 1912, this Bull Moose Party. But in the book, you really do laud Roosevelt for taking on J.P. Morgan, Standard Oil, the Northern Securities Trust. But he's sort of an enigmatic figure, I guess, in the book. He changed sort of his view, or maybe he didn't. Maybe talk about what Roosevelt signifies to you in this.
Yeah, Roosevelt's a really important figure in American history, but also American industrial history. So what he does that I laud him for, and I think he's a hero in this respect, you know, he inherits the presidency, not literally, but takes it over after the assassination of McKinley, and immediately changes the policy of the United States towards monopoly. Before that time, McKinley, other members of the Republican Party, had basically taken an aid and comfort approach to monopoly. They had been willing to allow mergers to monopoly. They did not really enforce the Sherman Act, sorry, the antitrust laws, in any serious ways. And Roosevelt changed that all, I think very courageously, went out and sued J.P. Morgan within a year of assuming the presidency. And, you know, that was not something for the faint of heart, because obviously he was running straight at the base of the Republican Party at that point. But he did it, and he also later would sue John Rockefeller, whose Standard Oil Company was one of the most powerful corporations on Earth. So I think that kind of courage actually is what we need in our times, and I give Roosevelt a lot of credit. The
sort of a traitor to his class kind of situation, much like FDR as well.
Yeah, and that's right. Some people are like, "What's going on here?" Morgan, had dinners with Roosevelt, and you know, Roosevelt was born, but he was a Democrat, I think, in his stomach, in his heart, and he thought that if the government didn't do something, that it was just much more likely you'd have a communist revolution or anarchism. He sort of saw breaking up the big companies as a middle path between socialism and unfettered capitalism. But later in his career, and you know, you said he was enigmatic, he kind of started to change his thinking, became frustrated a little bit, and maybe he got a little power hungry, I'm not sure, but he had a new vision that he announced in 1910, which was that he wanted monopolies, but he wanted them to be sort of under his control. So he wanted, or not his control, but the control of the federal government. So he kind of imagined something like, you know, Saudi Arabia and its oil concern, you know, which is controlled by the Saudi Arabian state, or actually something not unlike what Mussolini would push for in, later on in the 20s and 30s, which is a really state-directed economy. And that's the position he took in the 1912 election, obviously based on my leanings and a fondness for Brandeis. I think that was misguided. So you really have a figure who had a period of greatness, but I think pursued a profoundly misguided vision later in life. Fortunately, he was rejected by the American voters, and I think that in its way was almost a constitutional moment, because people were voting on economic policy. Do you want to have a sort of nationalized economy full of monopolies, or a more competitive economy based on breakups and antitrust law and sort of the traditional way of doing business? So and we've never kind of overcome that. You know, I think we've drifted back somehow, but I think that election should be sort of front of our mind when we consider economic policy today.
Right. I'm speaking with Tim Wu. He's the author of a new book called The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. So you kind of take us on this ride in this book. So there was this moment, this fulcrum point in 1912, and then antitrust policy is sort of enforced, even though it sort of lay dormant after the passage of the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890. And particularly after the Great Depression, breaking up monopolies and making sure that there is competition in these markets becomes of primary importance. And then it all changes. Right in like sort of the 1970s, 1980s, where you say we took the ante out of antitrust. And so maybe we can talk about what happened in the 70s and 80s and who were the key figures that led to this retrenchment that has ushered in all this consolidation in market after market.
Yeah. So as you said, after the Second World War, there was even more emphasis on antitrust, even more antitrust enforcement, based on the negative examples of Nazi Germany and Italy and Japan, which had giant monopolies wielding a lot of political influence and frankly becoming tools of the state in the war effort. And so there was a sense that, you know, democracy needed to have some kind of antitrust enforcement. But then you fast forward to the 1980s, as you suggested, there's a particularly influential professor and judge named Robert Bork, probably most famous for having been denied Supreme Court seat, or borked, in the 1980s. But he was, among his various projects, the, I guess, main originator, along with another fellow named Aaron Director, of an argument that the antitrust laws should be, and in fact were intended to be, much more limited than anyone had ever thought before, that they really were just meant to focus on increased prices to consumers. You know, that was the only real issue that they were designed to deal with, and so they should be very minimally enforced, if at all. Right. And, you know, that was a pretty radical break from what had been going on. It wasn't consistent with what Congress had said or the 1912 election, which I'd suggested. But in the 80s, it gained a lot of popularity in the Republican Party. Big business obviously liked the theory. They were sick of being broken up, sick of any government scrutiny. And it also dovetailed with a rising right-wing, particularly Republican Party, resistance to the courts. Bork portrayed antitrust as sort of part of the 1960s activist judiciary that was changing American life as you knew it. You know, Roe v. Wade, First Amendment, Vietnam War protesters, and antitrust, sort of added them all together. And so, you know, bit by bit, the antitrust laws were hollowed out during the Reagan administration. It got worse during the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, and the second Bush administration. So it has never really recovered from these periods. And the Democratic Party hasn't been that committed to the laws either. They've said they should be enforced and kind of resisted, but they haven't, you know, strongly resisted this movement, and, right, you know, judges haven't really been screened on these policies. So sorry, I'm going a little too long here, but yes, that is the movement, and I think we're still in the midst of it 40 years later.
Yeah. It seems like this has sort of taken over this concept, this consumer welfare standard, as you were talking about, that only consumer prices should be considered when you're talking about monopolies and corporate concentration. But I think there's a point that you make over and over again in the book, and you've made it in this interview, that often gets missed, which is about sort of correlating these anti-monopoly measures with human freedom, that the idea that we can either have democratic regulation of the economy and the market, or private firms will then regulate it in their own interests. And that limits freedom for whether it's a worker to conduct the kind of things that it wants to participate in the economy, or an innovator to find a new thing to bring forward into the marketplace or whatever. I mean, it's really about this difference between freedom and this kind of merging of corporations in the state. I mean, is that kind of your core thesis?
Yeah, it is. And I think it's something we've really lost, the sense of freedom has both economic and political dimensions. You know, sometimes we have this sort of thinner idea of freedom, which means, well, you have the right to vote and maybe the right to speak. But, you know, what about your economic freedoms? You know, what about how you're treated as an employee? What about what it's like to try to start a new business? How is life lived? What are your working hours? You know, these were things that people cared about in the first Gilded Age, and they have a lot to do with corporate power and corporate size. You know, I think many people today and then feel sort of powerless in the face of companies that are so much bigger than them that they, you know, really have no accountability. You know, how many times today is it that you feel that you don't really have any say over what the laws are that govern this country? That's one aspect. Your political freedom is, in fact, meaningless if Congress only does what companies want, which I think on many issues is just the way it is. You know, look at tax policy. Just take one example. You know, where was the middle class tax cut? It's never happened. It's always been something else. And I think, you know, many of us, you have rising bills. Your cable bills go up, or airline seats get smaller, or drug prices go through the roof. And you feel like you just have no, there's no real ability to resist these changes.
Right.
There's no competition, no way to do anything. Sorry to go on and on.
Yeah,
but
not at all.
I think this is the problem. This is the challenge of our times, is understanding what it means to be free.
Right. You put it as, you quoted Brandeis, you say a right to live and not merely to exist.
Yes, I think that gets at it, you know,
yeah.
That you're not free. This is another Brandeis quote, if you're subject to the arbitrary industrial will of somebody else.
Right.
And I think that many of us, you know, don't feel that way. You know, if you work for one, you can't switch jobs because everybody else is paying the same wages or there's not many options. You know, I don't know. There's so many ways in which, and look, I don't think we have absolute freedom to do whatever you want, whenever you want, but I think that we just, I think many people feel stacked against them. They don't have a real say in their economic lives, and their vote doesn't matter the way it should when it comes to what people want. And so, you know, here you are, and you know, this is a democracy, and we're citizens, but since what happened to the idea that we're supposed to be in charge?
Yeah. So, I mean, that hooks up with something I've recently written about at The Intercept, which is reporting on some polling from the Open Markets Institute, which is sort of the lead new Brandeis Institute that's looking at this, a think tank, showing like really broad concern with monopolies, like 70% and 80% support for the idea that monopolies have too much power to influence politicians, too much power, you know, within the economy, and a real desire to bust them up. Now, you were briefly a political candidate. You ran for lieutenant governor of New York. What do you see as the political potency of this issue? Because when we're talking about, you know, markets and legal structures and changes that need to be made to pretty abstract laws, it might not hit politically in a certain way. But what you were talking about just now, that does seem to have a political dimension. So how do we build sort of an antitrust movement?
I mean, great question. The people who answered that question the best were the original revolutionaries. If I'm in Boston right now, and the original Boston Tea Party was a anti-monopoly revolution.
Right.
You know, there's been a long storied history of revolts and revolutions and action against economic injustice. And, you know, I mean, it's led to revolution. That's not like a joke. It happened.
Right.
And I think this is a big issue. I think we need candidates who talk distinctly and clearly about being anti-monopoly candidates. There was once an anti-monopoly party in the United States, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe it was called the Antitrust Party. You know, this was a widespread movement, and it can become one again. And I think one thing that helps, it's not really a right-wing or left-wing issue necessarily. It's sort of more us, the humans, against the, you know, against the few concentrated industries.
And it's also like the laws are on the books, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we have the Sherman Act. We have, you mentioned, the Seller-Kefauver Act, which is also known as the Anti-Merger Act. And that's a theme in your book, is that these laws exist and Congress has sort of made its intentions clear, and we've sort of just perverted those intentions.
No, I agree. I actually think the laws exist. I think it wouldn't be a bad idea that Congress to either through resolution mm-hmm. or through new laws say, hey, we actually meant what we said here, courts.
Right.
Because some of the courts are part of the problem, too.
Right.
Supreme Court being an example. You know, here is what the people want. You know, there's a movement in the streets, even within both parties. And the courts are still acting like it's, you know, 1984 or something like that, 1985, I don't know. Where there, this year there was a decision by the Supreme Court authored by Justice Thomas about credit cards,
sure.
about American Express and the credit card. They have blatantly anti-competitive moves to keep out lower-priced rivals, and they're like, well, no, we don't really think this is a problem. So part one thing I think that is important would be for Congress to remind the courts that they really believe in what they said in the antitrust laws. That's one of the things I'm pushing for. I think we need better judicial appointments where judges have taken a stand on these economic justice issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I think there is a movement. I think it can be stronger. And as I said before, I think it ignites a broad swath of Americans who really have had it and are asking, like, what happened to the American promise here?
Right.
You know, what is this about? And we did this before. You know, the late 19th century, people were mad.
Yeah.
Burning things. They were going, you know, at the Granger movement, farmers were almost in revolution. And yeah, I think it's time to get angry.
Well, time to get angry. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Tim Wu. The book is The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. Thanks for coming on Background Briefing.
Sure. Pleasure.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm David Dayan, sitting in for Ian Masters. Thanks to our producer, Graham Fitzgibbon. You can find this program at backgroundbriefing.org, and you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, coworkers on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow my reporting on Twitter at ddayen, D-D-A-Y-E-N. And I also have a newsletter where I send out links to all the stories that I write, and that's at tinyletter.com/DavidDayan. And hope you have a good rest of your day and a good weekend. Thanks.